This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone, to yet another episode of Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z. I'm Matt Fonslow, and I get respect. Your cash and your jewelry is what I expect. Tonight, I have the distinct pleasure of having a regular, who I've called her a regular before, because she is a regular. I don't know if she's regular, but she's on regularly. Her name, Margaret Light. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist, and also the owner of Equilibrium Therapy Services. I'm very excited to have you on. And to be honest, I've been looking forward to this topic for a long time. We are going to talk about porn. And I have my list of top 10 right here.
No.
What?
That's not the discussion we'll be having.
Oh. I got my list.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, top 10 is not the direction we're going.
Oh, I must have misunderstood then.
Yeah. No one wants to know that.
I'm sure somebody would be interested. You can email me or something.
Yeah. Full disclosure, someone should definitely email Matt if they're interested in his top 10 list of porn.
Yes.
Like, they should send him a really detailed email.
No, that's all right. Oh, before we get rolling too fast here, let's just take a moment to thank our sponsor, Napa Auto Tech Training. Napa Auto Tech's team of ASC Master Certified Instructors are conducting over 1,200 classes covering 28 automotive topics. To see a selection, go to NapaAutoTech.com for more details. All right. Well, thanks for joining me. I know I'm joking around a little bit to begin with, but it's really not a joking matter because it's a real thing. I think it gets kind of, I don't know if ignored is quite the right word, dismissed, along with sex addictions and even adrenaline junkie type stuff where, you know, okay, that's not a real addiction. It's not like a substance use type of disorder or nothing on that level of some of these more, or at least deemed more severe addictions or abuses. Access to it is so much easier than years before, but also it's kind of mainstream. You know, it's in movies, mentioned in movies, joked about in movies, joked about it at the water cooler. So it kind of loses some of that, I guess, seriousness, if you will. And yet it is responsible for destroying relationships for sure. And I have no doubt, to a degree, at least, lives.
Very true. It is a super important topic. And there's a lot there already, just because... Yes, this is a topic that gets dismissed, but it also depends on who you talk to, how they talk about it, and how they treat it, and whether it's viewed as an issue or not. And even sort of the languaging around pornography use is actually up for debate, even in professional circles. So as someone who has additional training in sex therapy and does that as a specialization, we actually don't even agree as a field on how we refer to this, because we hear language around like sex addiction or pornography addiction, but that actually isn't a formal diagnosis. The research is still out on whether certain types of pornography use even does the same thing in the brain that other addictions do. So you'll also hear people use language like out of control sexual behavior, out of control pornography use, compulsive or obsessive pornography use, problematic pornography use. Like, it's a whole gambit just because we haven't researched it a ton, right? And the research that's out there, it's really hard to find research about pornography use as it relates to individual health, sexual health, relational health, that isn't biased in some way.
I suppose it's hard to do the randomized controlled trials to really do like the gold standard for studies. And then I guess I'm just thinking too, like, I don't want to I don't want to, but I always seem to jump around a lot. But the reality is you have just the addiction portion, the abuse portion of porn being used as some sort of a fill-in or a supplement or a way to avoid a coping mechanism. But then we have a more subtle thing, which I'm talking to somebody who would know firsthand, and not, I don't mean from a porn standpoint, but porn also, especially with young people, sets them up for very, very unrealistic expectations. And because it's quote unquote more realistic than, say, like watching a superhero movie or an action movie, you know, a lot of us guys might wish we could be like John Wick if we had to be, but the chances are just as low as us trying to run around and be Batman or Spider-Man. And yet porn kind of does the same thing, where it sets up young people, not just males but females as well, and any spectrum in the middle, what to expect, not only from physical forms but also behaviors. It skews the results terribly.
This is the intersection between porn use and sexual health and education. So kind of the place I start with all of my clients, I get a lot of clients, particularly men, who come in because either they or somebody else is concerned about their pornography use, right? And the stance I kind of take with everybody is, I'm not pro-porn and I'm not anti-porn. My interest as a clinician lies in how their use of porn impacts the various facets of their life, right? Individual health, sexual health, relational health, and anything else. No, mainstream porn does not provide sex education, right? Certainly doesn't provide good sex education. So that sort of links into, like, how are we talking to young people and educating young people about sexual health, sex within relationships, what to expect, things like that, right? We have a term, and I like it, porn educated. And those are the folks who are like, well, I didn't get sex ed. I watched porn, and that's how I learned everything I know about sex. And yes, that can totally create issues. The one sort of plug I'll throw in there now is, there is actually porn now, you have to go looking for it, but that is designed to be educational and is well vetted. So that's its own little like thing. But mainstream porn, Pornhub, places like that, not designed to be educational. Marty Klein draws an analogy between kind of mainstream porn and Marvel movies, which I think is really helpful in terms of like, mainstream porn is essentially a Marvel movie. Like, it can be fun, it can be enjoyable, but if you watch a Marvel movie and think you can go do any of the things you see in that movie, you're set up to fail. And it's a lot of the same ideas with mainstream porn, right? If you watch that and think, okay, that's what sex is going to look like, no, it's not. In most cases, no, it's not.
Yeah, it sets up unrealistic expectations. Not only, like, what your expectations may be of a partner, but also your expectations of yourself. I think this is something women have had to deal with for a long time. I guess being objectified. It's now coming around to men, and they don't like it. As crazy as that sounds.
I think there's two pieces to that, right? When we talk about porn and expectations and relationships, in cishet couples, which is where we see most of the conflict around porn use, there's a few things that happen there, right? There's varying definitions of what sexual fidelity is and what people believe cheating is or not. So that's like a value and a definition thing we have to navigate. But then there's also the piece of, is one or both partners believing or feeling that because someone's watching porn, that is now the expectation of them, right? And it can happen in one or both, right? Like, if it's the male partner watching porn, could he have unreasonable expectations? Sure, totally, right? But I've also seen times where he can be very clear of like, no, I understand, like, this is not what you're going to do or look like, but there's still an internalized thing for her where that fear exists. or there's a sense of like, what's wrong with me or why am I not good enough that you're doing this? So there's a lot there.
This is a big topic, really. I mean, obviously, it's probably one of those, even same with like a sex addiction, where it would be very difficult for somebody that is to admit that they are. You know what I mean? It's bad enough with like a substance use disorder. They don't think they have a problem. And yet the symptoms may be missing work, pulling away from relationships now with whatever substance or activity. Well, the same with porn, but you're probably not missing work a lot because of it, unless it's like a video game's coming out and you just can't wait for it to be released. And so you're calling in sick so you can be ready for it. I don't know about that.
So let's talk about for a minute what warning signs around porn use could be, right? Because there is totally a way to use porn in a way that facilitates sexual health, is acceptable relationally, is okay individually. There's totally a way to do that. And we should talk about that at some point.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are also signs that something's going wrong. So the big warning signs I see, and this happens more often than people think, is about where they use it, how much they're using it, and the feelings that come with use. So the amount of people I see who come to me because they're using porn in a public location is really high. We're talking about people using it in public bathrooms. They're watching it. They're not masturbating in this scenario, but they're watching it as they're grocery shopping or as they're driving to work, or they're watching it and masturbating at work. Those would be all signs that there's something happening for you, right? I think we all agree that that is not an appropriate place for that activity.
Or while you're waiting for your car to get repaired and you're still Bluetooth to the radio and now the shop knows.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it sounds like that's happened.
I've heard of that happening.
Yeah. It's not that uncommon. People use it as they're driving down the highway. People use it their kid's school in the public restroom. Like any of that would be a sign something is going on around this that maybe needs some help, right? If you're hiding it, if you're spending a ton of money on it, right? That isn't just buying porn. That's like, I can't buy groceries or I can't pay my rent because I've spent so much on porn, right? I'm lying to my spouse or my partner about it, or I'm racking up credit card debt, or, I mean, all of those would be huge signs that like, hey, this is a problem.
And you know darn well there's people listening to that, just that part, like racking up credit card debt, not being able to make rent, do this spending money on porn. When we think like, well, there's so much available for free, it kind of going like, really? But I think it's absolutely really. And also, like a lot of things, you may start out at, you know, whatever the free stuff is. And the more, I don't know what, hate to say mundane, but I guess we'll just say vanilla. But that usually doesn't last after a while because there's more and other even like taboo type of situations and whatnot. You start veering over that way. Well, if you have to keep going to get that same response, if you will, or the feedback or rush is maybe an okay word, you're going to start paying money. You have to.
So full disclosure, we should make a distinction between like paying for porn and paying for porn to a place that's problematic, right? I'm actually a big fan and a big advocate for paying for your porn because truthfully, you're paying for a product, you're paying for a service. Why do you think you should get this for free? Especially if there's any concern around like ethical pornography use, right? Do you want the actors and actresses to be paid a living wage? Do you want them to have access to health care and benefits like anybody else who does work does, right? Like, so you should pay for your porn.
Not being leveraged. Yep.
Right. Yeah. Yep, like, do absolutely. You want to make sure this is consensual and there's testing and healthy working standards and
of
conditions?
Age. Legal age. Yep.
Correct.
Yeah, 100. That's a really good point.
Right. Pay for your porn. And there comes a point where you could be paying so much for your porn that it's causing a negative impact on your life. That is different. Or if you're lying about it, that would be a relational problem. The other thing I would throw out there is this idea of, is your porn use escalating in some way, right? Here's the reality about sexual health and sexual interests. If you can think of it or imagine it, there is porn out there about it. If you can't imagine it, there is porn out there about it. Like, sexual interests are a huge spectrum, right? From a sexual health perspective, if it is consensual, if it is made between consenting parties, we're not going to shame that, right? Now, people do come to see me really frequently because they are uncomfortable with a sexual interest or something they are watching. That's a different thing, right? That can be an individual thing, right? It could be technically a sexually healthy practice, but if it's misaligned with your personal values or how you think you should be, or it's negatively impacting your interest in other sexual acts, right? If it's sort of like narrowing the menu of things you're interested in, well, that could be a problem potentially. We're also thinking about people do miss work when they have an out of control porn problem, or they skip family activities, or they're causing themselves physical harm in some way, or it's feeling really compulsive or obsessive, or like, hey, if I don't use porn, then I literally obsess about it in my brain all day long until I do, and I try not to, but I can't stop. Those would all be really big warning signs that something's going on, right? That sense of being out of control, or I can't prevent it, or it's I can't focus on anything else.
Is an honest question with a correlation that may not exist, but with substance use, just pick on alcohol. There are many that they can't relax or they can't unwind at night after work or whenever they're after work. I guess it doesn't matter what time. They just can't do it without the aid of one or two. I'm not even saying they're getting buzzes. They need something. How about with pornography, in that I can't perform the act with my significant other or consenting partner without the aid of watching it?
There's two parts to the question. If you want to be able to have sex with a consenting partner and you feel like you can't without watching porn and it's causing distress, yes, that could be indicative of a problem. Now, is it a pornography problem? Is it something like a relational problem? Is there like, you know, there's maybe a question like, do you enjoy the sex you have with your partner? Like, there's kind of a series of questions that come with that of nailing down what is the problem. But yes, it could be a problem. The other piece of that, and I like that you brought up alcohol, because with alcohol, most of us are familiar with, hey, we had a long day at work, or right, a really long week. Like, you have a drink, but it's an occasional thing. But it does, like, it helps alleviate stress. People find it enjoyable, but it doesn't negatively impact life. And it's not your only stress relief technique, right? It's not the thing you turn to every single time. Porn is actually super similar in that pornography use and masturbation, from a sexual health perspective, actually can be part of like stress management in an acceptable way. If that is the only thing you have for stress management, that's a problem. A lot of this isn't black or white, because it's even possible to use pornography in a way that's sexually healthy, but relationally a problem.
And that's its own spectrum, because if you have a partner that just frowns on it, period, then you're more apt to do it in secret. You're more apt to lie about it, hide it. And it makes it tough. It almost sounds silly when you say it, though, you know, that you are watching out to watch, you know, something ethical. So you are paying for it to assure that. That makes it tough to hide too. It makes it that much more difficult. So you have that. And then, of course, the other end of the spectrum where they're happy to watch it with you and maybe even upset if you're watching it without them.
So sometimes what happens in these discussions is, okay, there's a conflict about porn and we automatically blame porn, right? And what I'm saying is we really need to separate out what is the problem here. Is it a pornography use problem? Is it a relational problem around porn? The content of the argument is porn, but it's really a relational problem because, bluntly, lying for years, no matter what it's about, is a relational problem. The minute that's found out, it's a problem. And even people who, let's say they have the conversation about porn and there's an agreement about, yeah, I don't mind if you watch porn, go for it. But then one day they find out that you're watching something that they don't know about or they haven't agreed to. And they're like, I'm okay with all this other stuff. And you go and watch the one thing I'm not okay with. Well, now you have a relational problem there too, right? And then there's also the individual perspective, which is, right, is the person themselves upset about their porn use in some way, right? Do they believe it's wrong? Do they believe they shouldn't be? Do they believe? I've even seen it where, like, the person using porn believes it's cheating, but their partner doesn't.
That's interesting. You know, whatever, I guess, I think it's honest. When you said that, not the part about the infidelity, but more shame associated with it, embarrassment would be more the fetish types that now they're in to see you because they are not okay with what they're watching, even though that's a really wide topic and it could be something very acceptable when we're talking about, again, consenting adults. Like infidelity, that never occurred to me, especially if you're the one viewing it, worried that you are the one being unfaithful. That's interesting.
Right. Super diverse topic, right? And we think we know. But like I said, if you can imagine it, it exists. And if you can't imagine it, that exists also, right? And we get a lot of messaging around how we should, quote unquote, be. What we should be interested in, what we should do, how we should look like, what it should feel like. And it's a very narrow box.
Very. And because of it, you may not be able to open yourself up, I guess. You know, I was going to say relax and enjoy it, but you're so worried about hitting these targets or learned behaviors that you saw, you don't. And now the actual viewing of it is more rewarding than the actual act itself. It's almost like kids nowadays, a lot of them, it seems like they're more willing to watch kids play on like a YouTube or whatever. They're more okay watching kids play than actually playing themselves. It's interesting. And it seems like, or not seems like that, I know that that's a thing with pornography.
Right. So there's a super interesting discussion there around the purpose of pornography for individuals. When do they use it and why? Right. So sometimes what I see happen when pornography use becomes problematic is it becomes an emotion regulation tool and it becomes someone's only emotion regulation tool. Right. And people vary in how much awareness they have of this, right? Some people are really able to come to me and say, whenever I feel bored, I use porn. All right, well, that's a good first step. We've identified the emotion that this is linked to, right? But other folks are like, I'm viewing it 25 times a day and I have no idea why. And sometimes it's multiple emotions. I'm stressed, I'm bored, I'm sad, I'm hungry, I'm pissed. Any emotional experience, this is my solution. I feel temporarily better. And then as soon as I have another emotion again, I need to use it again.
And it's so easy to do.
So easy.
Easy and accessible. Maybe a really, really bad correlation or relation, but it reminds me of some people I know that cut. You know, and I don't want to go, I mean, it's technically, I suppose, self-mutilation, but they many times are cutting multiple times a day for similar things that you just rattled off.
Well, right. It's an emotion regulation tool as well, right? So when I think about clinically, like, how am I going to help this person kind of morph their use into something that's more adaptive or facilitates more involvement in life? One of the things we know is that, and it doesn't actually matter because I do the same thing with folks who are cutting or self-harming. If you don't have any other emotion regulation skills, A, I can't actually take this skill away from you because, like, you're not going to abstain from it, right? That's not even realistic. And B, it might even be hurtful if I do, because if that's truly your only thing to cope with, where does that leave you if you have nothing else, right? So a major part of that work, and this is true for right out of control pornography use too, is can we start to expand your repertoire or the menu of options you have for coping with your emotions? Practicing other skills, right? And actually, from a sexual health perspective, if somebody's coming to me because they feel like I'm only interested in this one very specific sexual act or video or type or whatever it is, we're doing the same thing of working on how do we expand the menu of things that are sexually appealing to you, and how do we expand that menu to include the things your partner is willing to do. Like, that's part of good sex, is there has to be overlap between what you want and are willing to do and what your partner wants and is willing to do. If there's no overlap, you're having a tough time.
Yeah, and indicative of more issues that are outside of porn, and it could be amplified because of it. Like a lot of stuff, it's just not the root cause. A lot of times, not the root cause.
So sometimes I kind of talk about process versus content. The underlying process is the issue, right? It could be, I have no skills to deal with my emotions. I feel something, I'm not even aware of it. I don't know what to do with it. I just try and make it go away, right? That's the underlying process. Content is whatever you stick in the blank there. It doesn't matter if you fill it in with porn or cutting or alcohol or rage or workaholism. Like, content's content. The underlying thing is what we actually have to work on.
And still wildly, wildly unaddressed. I hate to say background. It's not like I have a background in it, but my life since being with Danielle, I guess not my life, but at least more of my experiences involve substance use disorders with chemicals, chemical dependencies. And that's so many is undiagnosed, untreated mental health disorders. And they're self-treating, or I suppose completely avoiding is still a treatment. Maybe not super effective, but it's a treatment. And this follows a lot of the same lines, where I can definitely see how it would allow you however long to check out and trigger more, you know, really probably dopamine in your brain than just saying, running off to the bathroom to watch 15 minutes of a Marvel movie. So, you know, there's more going on than just that, but it's definitely triggering, you know, our base, you have to say like reptilian brain level, but.
Well, the reality is, if you're pairing porn and masturbation and orgasm, by definition, you're releasing chemicals into your body. Like, that's just how that act works on a biological level. So there is something there about, like, you do feel good. That's just a fact of it. And here's the other piece of it, right? There's this idea of neuroplasticity in the brain, right? Our experiences, the things we do, they literally change the connections and, to some degree, the structure of our brain, right? So it doesn't matter what task we're doing over and over and over again. Any task we do repeatedly essentially creates a super strong connection in our brain on a cellular level. That's why you get better at things. That's why you get quicker at it, right? That's why it gets easy to do it automatically. So if your only coping skill in this scenario is pornography and masturbation, that pathway is just going to get really well developed in your brain. It's going to get really easy to do it instinctively, right? Those connections get formed. And then they take a lot of time and intentional effort to do anything else different. And again, that's with any skill or experience. There's nothing unique happening here.
It's one of my favorite topics, neuroplasticity. While you're writing your brain or constantly rewriting your brain, that many of these things, I guess what I would say is it should give you a little bit of hope. It won't be easy, but you can rewrite your brain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it won't be easy, but it is doable. The mistake we make sometimes is either thinking it's going to be easy, which it won't, or thinking that it's going to be quick, which it also won't, or in thinking that just because we've decided we need to make this change, we're never going to slip up ever again. Like, that's not realistic either, right? Even if what you do is decide, hey, I think I have a pornography problem and I need to stop using it, the reality is, even if you're seeking treatment, getting support, getting help, working at it, doing all the right things, you're going to use it again, and you're going to use it again in a way you don't want to. With time and practice, that frequency will decrease, but you will.
At risk of giving people license, but it's the truth. When you do, quote unquote, fall off the wagon, you're not freaking starting off at square one. I guess I've become hesitant to say sober or abstinent. Just you've gone cold turkey and it's been 2 weeks and then you fall off the wagon. You were still sober or abstinent for 2 weeks. I see that happen a lot. It's just like, fall off the wagon, well, square one, F it. It just goes, you know, worse.
Well, it's all or nothing thinking. I messed up once, so I might as well give up. That's a cognitive distortion, right? We've talked about those before. It's very black or white. It's all or nothing. And the thing I'll throw out there, right? If someone comes to me, or when someone says sex addiction or porn addiction, do I understand what they're referencing? Yes. I don't use that language professionally, because when we talk about other addictions to chemicals, alcohol, whatever, yes, a biological dependence can be created, or a physiological dependence can be created by certain substances, but we can actually live without them, right? When we're talking about things like sex, or the other thing I hear a lot about is food addiction, sex drive, sexual desire, like, it's an inherent biological thing. It's a piece of us that we can't get rid of. And so we're not going to be abstinent ever. And from a sexual health perspective, that's not even a realistic goal. The trick is, how do we use this in a way that is adaptive for me, that's healthy for me, that facilitates my health and well-being, that doesn't harm me in some way and doesn't harm my relationships? It's like when people talk about food addiction, you gotta eat. So you're not gonna abstain from that.
NAPA Auto Tech training sessions are being conducted day and night in the town near you. This training caters to every level within your organization, be it a mechanical assistant, a mechanical specialist, a technology specialist, or a driver safety calibration specialist. Imagine a one-stop shop training partner in NAPA Auto Tech that will lead your team to a path to greatness. Auto Tech's entry-level Build-A-Tech classes convert the untapped potential of your new hires into money-making mechanical specialists. Auto Tech's higher-level tech update classes introduce specialists to the world of ever-changing technologies, which prevents your shop from getting technologically stagnant. Remember, if you're not moving forward, you're falling behind. And, turning to the front of the store, the Auto Tech Service Advisor class is an awesome way to hone your client advocate skill set, ultimately benefiting the customer through an improved vehicle repair experience. But it doesn't stop there. Imagine an electric vehicle class that takes your specialist well past the mundane, yet necessary, safety topics. Well, it's here. Auto Tech's EV Ready Training is a week-long curriculum that takes participants through a hands-on experience involving hybrids and electric vehicles. The session kicks off with the use of PPE and proper tooling, while touching on required OSHA regulations. Then, the students dive into the lab vehicles to gain knowledge of the common high-voltage components on EV and hybrid vehicles and their function. Attendees will be taken on a path exposing them to different electric vehicle manufacturers to compare component form and location. Additionally, information about Level 1 and Level 2 charging systems will be included, along with a quick look at DC to DC charging. The operation and maintenance of subsystems are explored, including the different modes of Tesla operations, and so much more. So what are you waiting for? Commit to taking your business to the next level with NAPA Autotech Training. I don't know if it's wanting to discuss as much as I just feel like it's a thing when we're talking about the content and how the algorithms for the systems using for accessing porn are playing on things, not just, it could be individual, but I don't know as much individual as like the scope of all the users and how it in itself can help, and help's a bad word, but drive preferred content. I think years ago, it would be just, you know, it would be either homosexual or heterosexual primarily, and consenting adults, attractive, whatever. And now, and it's probably been that way for the last few years, and it's been mentioned on many different, not just podcasts, but in the news and all that, is like a lot of the content is things like step parents, step siblings, step sons or daughters. And because of that, that helps drive what new users and people that are just using it, that are viewing it, it starts to drive what they want to consume more of, and can start skewing and messing with people's expectations. Is a really rough word. I'm thinking more what they would are more likely now to fantasize about when not watching. We see it and have seen it over and over and over. So I just remember, man, it was an interview with Hugh Hefner, who, if you don't know, was the owner of Playboy magazine. The point of the interview was he was asked, how have women changed through the years? Like, what do people find attractive? In this case, mostly men. And he said the faces, whoever was deemed beautiful when he first started, would still absolutely be considered beautiful today, which was, this is probably back in the very early 2000s, but the bodies have changed. And that was, I'm pretty sure it can be proven quite easily, that was driven a lot by media and what is shown to be these models, not so much just in Playboy magazines, but over and over, movies, magazines for fashion. The bodies have changed. And now they're starting to go a little bit the other way, probably, and thanks to Beyonce and those body types, is kind of going back to what you would say years ago, but it's kind of driven by what's fed to us. I think there's a very real thing going on where if you're not conscious, and for adults, which would probably hopefully be late 20s, early 30s, you can probably figure out, okay, what's going on, what I'm being fed, and how that should affect me in real life. But when you're young and people are accessing this long before they're adults, how is that shaping their, I guess, fantasy life? And I think it's affecting it very negatively.
So there's a lot there. I'll say there is a movement within the porn industry to try and create more inclusive content that's more body positive. So we're talking about queer porn, feminist porn, ethical porn, things like that. If you view any of that stuff, it is very, very different from the more stereotypical mainstream porn that you find on Pornhub. Like, completely different lens. You're talking about female-led, female-directed, right? Queer folk running and directing it. It's completely different. And there's actually a lot of it out there. And there's a fascinating component to that where some of those folks even feel like having access to high-quality ethical porn is part of sexual health and sexual rights. And so they offer a combination of free and paid, but it's something they're offering free by choice because they view it as like a human rights issue. If someone were wanting to be a responsible consumer of porn and be really thoughtful about who am I supporting, how is it produced, what's the representation in it, what's the messaging, who is this sort of like created, like who is in mind when this is created, there are totally ways to do that. So that's part of it. The second part of it is, yes, porn is created for adults, hopefully with a decent sexual education and sexual health understanding. We're going to come back to that in a minute. It is not created for adolescents. So adolescents do need to be talked to and taught how to effectively use pornography. And you end up in kind of the same position that we do with like the sex talk, where people are like, just don't do it. And then that's the end of the discussion. You can say don't do it all day long. The vast majority of adolescents are going to view it at some point in time. And a certain percentage of those adolescents are going to view it on a regular basis. So it's helpful if they have the knowledge to understand what they're watching and what it means and how do we talk about it in an effective way.
And that's the mainstream component, right? It's porn by itself is something we talk about. We joke around about and did it in high school. It was way not as accessible. And the scope of things was not nearly as accessible. And then every show they watch, even these shows that are streaming that are supposedly for adolescents, are showing behaviors that, again, I think it just keeps piling on the pressure and even self-expectations of what should happen. If I go to this party and I meet somebody I like, the next logical step isn't to just sit and have a conversation or go out on a date. It is immediately accelerated to, you know, quote unquote, the bedroom. There's a dangerous component to this.
Sexual education, sexual health, and relational skills and expectations for adolescents. And that's probably a whole discussion in and of itself of like, what are the things adolescents need to know in order to navigate this world, right? I heard a stat, it's old now, and I can't remember who put it out, but the stat was the average age of first viewing porn is between 9 and 11.
Ugh.
Kids that age do not have the cognitive, emotional, or social capacity to understand what they are viewing, to make sense of it cognitively, to emotionally process it, or even understand like what it means for their lives. So the takeaway of that is lots of parents think, oh, my kid isn't old enough to need to know about this. Yes, they probably are.
And society, just the way we handle sex in general, I mean, we've made it taboo. Like by definition, we've made it so taboo that it is not talked about somewhat openly in a way that would take a lot of the power of it, I guess, away. Or at least knock it down to where if they do see it somehow, some way, they can associate it more with fantasy on like the Marvel levels than documentary levels.
So the other piece of that is kind of the breadth of what's available, right? And that's that piece I said earlier. If you can imagine it, it exists. If you can't imagine it, it exists. I'm going to push a little bit on this idea that back in the day, things were different. Accessibility was different. I think social acceptance of diversity around sexual interests was different. But like, how far back are we going? If we go back enough, like far enough in history, it was acceptable to have sex with children and 13-year-old girls were getting pregnant. So like, I don't know if I really buy that. Now, there have definitely been changes in terms of accessibility and social acceptance, right? One of the things about the internet is that it is so easy to find anything you want to view. And this is part of kind of values and where sometimes I see conflict for folks internally around what am I watching and how does that conflict with my values? Because there's a lot of messaging around here's what's acceptable to be interested in. And then we have stuff that's like fringy but acceptable, for lack of a better word. And then there's the stuff there's a lot of judgment about.
I mean, I hope you're not talking about my Star Wars porn, but okay.
I mean, that exists. And like, oh, if that's your thing, go for it.
Yeah, you know, the cantina.
It's pretty mild compared to some of what's out there in all reality.
Yeah, I was thinking about the algorithm to comment that it's the obvious comparison is just politics. The algorithms of the systems are going to feed you what you start to watch and develop a history for, and then it's going to exaggerate it. That's what they do to increase your viewing time.
Correct. Potentially, right? I mean, we are talking about, right, an electronic platform that wants to make money, that runs on algorithms, right? And if you are not thoughtful about what you are viewing and why and what that means for you, yes, right? It could feed you more extreme content. Now, if you're okay with that, like, go for it, right? If that isn't a personal distress factor, and again, right, if it's made ethically, it's created with consenting adults, I'm going to say something like a little controversial, like it's not controversial in the sex therapy world, but it's controversially in the public. Even like consensual non-consent, right? If it's depicting non-consent, but it is made consensually, all right, like if that's your thing, you're allowed to be interested in that. So again, yes, that algorithm can, like, it will adapt to what you view in terms of what it suggests for you.
Yeah, and I'm thinking especially the free platforms, because they have to make money. And so the way they make money is with the ads, which means they have to keep you watching longer to see more ads to make their money. Or the pay for, I don't know that they have to care as much. You know, of course, they're going to kind of feed you.
They're still going to make suggestions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I don't know if the algorithms are so, I guess I'm going to go with so strong at feeding you things that will keep you on longer. Where if they're just getting their money, whether you watch 5 minutes or 5 hours, they're getting their money. They're good to go. But if you're a free one, like a Pornhub or a YouPorn, something of that, they need you to stay on there as long as they can. And it's not unlike Facebook, Instagram.
Certain people are going to be and are at more risk for viewing that, like viewing content they find distressing due to lack of sexual education, not understanding what's happening, being a little socially naive. All of those things set someone up for sort of like, for lack of a better term, falling victim to the suggestions, right? The other thing I'll say, and this is a complicated topic, is in our research on sexual responses in people, the way our brains are wired, our bodies do physiologically respond to sexual content, whether we want them to or not. Whether we allow ourselves to be consciously aware of it or not, whether it's something we're interested in or not, and whether it's something we'd actually want to do or not. And so if we don't know that, it is possible to watch a sexual act that we had never before thought of, experience physiological arousal, and then panic and judge ourselves because, oh my God, does this mean I'm into this? No, it doesn't necessarily. It means your body's doing what it's wired to do. But that's the sexual education piece of, like, I don't know what your sex ed was like. Nobody taught me that in sex ed.
Not that. No, no. I would say mine was a little more progressive than a lot, where it wasn't, it may have been like abstinence. I hate to say abstinence-based. Of course, it was strongly suggested because it's 100%. And not just so much 100% pregnancy, but also STDs. But then it was like, the reality is many of you are going to. And if you're not going to, like, this year, you might the year after, the year after. So then, but never anything like this about your response being a lot more involuntary than you think. And those responses not being indicative of what you're actually into.
Correct. Lots of people watch things in porn that they never actually want to do. And just because you have an arousal response doesn't mean you're into that. And here's the other piece that people don't understand. Just because you feel aroused by something doesn't mean you actually have to do anything with it. And that's like groundbreaking for men in particular. They're like, no, I have to. I'm like, no, you really don't. There's no rule. Like, there is no rule that says now I must. It's a bodily sensation like anything else. But if we don't know that, it's easy to watch things online and then be all types of twisted up about what does this mean about me? Or what does this mean about my partner that they watched this? I think we make an assumption that older people are better informed sexually, and they're not.
Arguably worse.
Well, could be worse, right? I met people who are 65 who have less sexual education and health understanding than some 13-year-olds. Like, so whatever you're thinking about geared towards younger people, I think the question that there is, like, if you lack education as a young person, could you write that in adulthood? Sure, but lots of people don't. And so some people go through life, the entire lifespan, never expanding that knowledge. And so the assumption they held about sex when they were 13 is the same one they hold when they're 65. So it still applies to adults. We like to think it doesn't, but it does.
We have a very, very large group of, I would say, younger people. So I don't mean teenagers so much. 20s and 30s somethings, where you would expect that's when they're starting to meet people, date, get into relationships, have sex, have families. It's greatly reduced, greatly affected. And a lot of that is being attributed to, of course, the online dating part. And we've talked about that a little bit. You, Tracy, and I were talking about that. But also the effect of, or I don't know about the effect of porn, but having porn available, that it's fulfilling a need that probably should be filled going out and meeting people and forming, you know, good, positive relationships, healthy relationships that lead to a sexual relationship, but it's being replaced by porn. And we're seeing that happen with drops in birth rates and just, I think, in relationships in general. It's easy to look at marriage. I think a sign of the times is this marriage is dropping off anyways. But that's one thing to point at, is we're not seeing a lot of this happen because people are, get done with work, go home. They got their phone and they're not out meeting people. And it's kind of taken the place of, or helping a generation of people not have a lot of interactions and relationships with people.
I have sort of mixed thoughts on that in terms of, I truthfully don't know if there is, and if there is, I haven't seen any good research on kind of linking like access to porn and lowered birth rates or dating rates or long-term pairing rates. So I don't know about that. I can say the research I have seen about like the birth rate falling, there's a lot more links there around like employment, access to childcare, health insurance, kind of socioeconomic stuff. I personally, and I have not met all people by any stretch of the imagination, I personally have not met someone who's ever said to me, I don't need a relationship because I have access to porn. I'm not saying those folks don't exist, but I have not met them.
I will say I've never met someone that stated it that way either.
The thing I will say, and I kind of want to put a plug in there for like this idea of meeting a need, right? I do think that's something to consider when we're talking about how to use porn in a way that facilitates health, right? So really think about what is the purpose right now? Because if somebody's using porn in reaction to loneliness, okay, well, porn actually isn't fixing your loneliness problem. And that's that emotional, like, regulation piece of I'm sad, I'm lonely, what do I do with that? So there's that idea. There's definitely a discussion, and this is baked into our culture and values around what do we do with sexual desire and needs, and whose job is it to fulfill those needs and roles, right? And that gets into the relational piece, which is a really good discussion because couples navigate this differently, right? Some couples, actually, porn is a really useful part of their relationship because you might have someone who says, like, listen, if you just want to get off, I don't want to be a part of that. I want you to go use porn and masturbate because, like, I don't want to feel used. Like, that feels using to me and I don't want to. Okay, well, that's actually really adaptive. Then you were tired, I didn't want to wake you, you were sick, whatever, whatever, right? If that's something a couple negotiates and agrees upon, that can work really well. And then there are definitely folks who believe any sexual need needs to be met relationally. And then again, okay, I guess you have to navigate that as a couple because what happens if you're sick? What happens if you're tired? What happens if you're not available? Like, what are the expectations around that? And even defining, right? What kind of porn is accessible or acceptable, right? What about interactive porn? What about OnlyFans where you can make requests or watch something live? Is that appropriate? Is it okay to follow porn stars on Instagram and comment on their photos? Like, what if you're direct messaging them, right? Like, we really need to expand the conversation we have relationally and then really spending time on, like, any other conflict. How are we going to manage our differences on this? Because some of them are going to be easily resolvable and some of them aren't. And we're going to have to manage that perpetual problem like we do any other perpetual problem.
Well, I mean, heaven forbid that your chosen partner, your chosen, we'll just say life partner, long-term relationship partner, that you'd be able to talk to them about just about anything and bring it up and just say, you know, we should talk about this now, and being able to have a mature conversation where both people can kind of say their piece and be heard and given an ounce of credit. One thing that you and I know we've discussed it a little bit off microphone and not recording, but there's also addictions to drama. Somebody coming to you, your partner coming to you with this early on in a relationship, like, how do we handle, how should we navigate this? Instead of being able to just have that conversation, it's got to turn into something big and, you know, a meltdown or whatever. Whether they asked to about it or not, brought it up before the fact or after the fact that it was found out. And then, okay, can we talk about this? You know, well, I felt like this, and I didn't mean, of course, I would never want you to feel that way about it. And somewhere there might be a compromise, or one or the other is deemed correct.
And the other thing I've seen people do relationally is just avoid it, right? Like, maybe we start the conversation and someone says, well, I don't like it. And they're like, oh, okay. And then they lie for the next however long. No, I don't use it. No, I don't use it. Or they lie by omission, which is still a lie, which is we just never talk about it and I just never disclose because they don't need to know, as if that's an acceptable relational practice. Like, if it wouldn't fly with anything else, it doesn't fly in this department either.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty insane what people won't talk to their significant other about.
And that's the relational skills piece around this, right? Is when we do talk about porn relationally, can we do it respectfully? Can we navigate the conflict well? Can we verbalize caring for each other? Do we blame or shame, or do we try to understand? Do we fire off and tell someone they're an idiot and they're wrong, right?
Like, I mean, that's my favorite thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why the conversation goes bad at that point.
I don't either.
It's a mystery.
I'll figure it out.
Someday.
But
clearly not a you problem.
Well, yeah.
It takes these good relational skills to do that, right? And that's talking about if somebody is congruent within themselves around like, yep, I do this. Here's why. Here's when. It's not my only stress relief or emotion regulation skill. I've dealt with my internalized shame around it. It doesn't negatively impact me in other areas, et cetera, et cetera. I don't use at work. All those things.
Credit needs to be given where credit is due, because I think it was really, really, really good of you to bring up the pay for stuff early, because that could be a potential solution if you're having misgivings with, okay, we're male dominated. Most of the people listening to this are males, men. The wife finds out that they're watching, or maybe they knew about it, but they're not really okay with it.
We've just kind of avoided that conflict. Yes, that's familiar.
And I feel like you brought up a very valid potential solution that maybe they would feel better about it if it's like, okay, you know, have this discussion about it and say, I'd stop watching the free stuff. Here are a couple of websites or whatnot providers that I have found. They're pay for, but they're guaranteed to be ethical and without going into recovering what we've already talked about. That could be a solution. And even if you're, as the man, you know, the listeners, presume you're, you know, overwhelmingly male, if you're in hot water over this, you could bring this up as a potential solution and not, you know, I don't think it's chest beating like, well, we could get some pay for stuff. That the idea is it's ethical. And like you said, women generated, directed, created, and hopefully the women aren't as objectified, or if they are, it's like the consensual objectification, if that makes sense.
One of the best relationship skills navigating porn I've ever heard had to do with A, just open and honest conversations around porn, paying for porn so that it's ethically produced, consensual, all that good stuff. But there was this moment of, I think I read this in a book somewhere or something, about how do you help your partner feel safe related to this porn use, right? How do you provide reassurance? How do you provide validation that you're still attracted to them, right? How do you have that conversation in a compassionate way? And even thinking about, okay, well, what if the actresses I'm drawn to have a similar body type to my spouse? Does it help her to know that you're not watching someone that she's never going to look like? Does it help her to know that you're thoughtful about that? Does it help her to know that, like, is there a way that this is being used to be considerate of your partner, right? I know you're really tired from the kids. I feel guilty if I approach you for sex when I know you're exhausted. Okay. It still might be a tough conversation, but how do you demonstrate care for the other person in this? How do you help your partner not feel threatened by this, right?
I get them a Hallmark card, but...
I mean, I don't think Hallmark does, like, let's talk about porn cards, but you could build that on, like, the Hallmark card maker. You could do that, right? But I think it's something similar of, like, okay, so let's say your coworker gets a really attractive, or let's say your partner gets a really attractive coworker. Well, you're probably going to talk about that. How do you demonstrate care? How do you demonstrate your commitment and your fidelity? Like, and again, if you've reached an impasse, right? If there's no discussion around this, if no one can remain regulated in the discussion, then it's probably time to seek therapy from a therapist with additional training, right? And I say that because as therapists, we're not actually obligated to get additional training before treating sexual issues, which to me just spells disaster, because who knows what that person believes or thinks. So you want to make sure it's someone who's going to be thoughtful about it. But just like you would for any other relationship issue, right? If this is a sticking point, get therapy.
It's just a terrific way to end. I really appreciate you coming on and talking about this.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is great.
For those of you listening, I hope you enjoy this. If these are the topics you want to hear more of, if there's more that we could cover on topics that we've covered already, especially with involving Margaret here, because she is a tremendous resource for us. I am thrilled to know her and consider her a friend and have her on. So thank you again, Margaret, for coming on. Margaret Light, Equilibrium Therapeutic Services. Look her up. And especially if you're in Minnesota, right? Minnesota, if you're looking for someone to talk to that's kind of got a bit of a finger on the pulse of the industry and where you're at, it's tough to ignore.
Thank you for having me on. And yes, in Minnesota, and if you're in a different state, if you reach out, I'm happy to help folks try and get established with someone in their state also.
And like always, you can email me at mattfonzelpodcast@gmail.com. And thank you to the Aftermarket Radio Network for letting me do this. Thank you to Knapp Autotech Training for sponsoring. And until next time, please take care.
You've been listening to Matt Fonslow, diagnosing the aftermarket A to Z on the Aftermarket Radio Network. Follow Matt on your favorite listening app. He's very interested in what you have to say. Let him know what you'd like him to cover and come on the show. Matt is all for advancing the aftermarket. Find Matt Fonslow on social media and connect or on aftermarketradionetwork.com.